Hi everyone, welcome to the Sunlight Media Podcast. I'm your host, Angelo Fresina, and today's guest is attorney Tristan Brown from the Teal Brown Law Firm.
Hello, Tristan.
Hey, Angelo.
Hey, Tristan. How you doing?
Hey, pretty good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, everything's fine. Go ahead.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks for being my second guest on the Sunlight Media Podcast. Great to have you on board.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me in. Sounds like a pretty good platform that you have here.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you and I have been discussing, you know, various SEO things the last few weeks, and podcasting is definitely a great way to build links and build, you know, branding kind of trust for your business as well. But, you know, we can go into that in a little more detail after this call, but keep that in mind. Podcasting is a great thing and a great way to get your message and services out there. And it's always good for us to get on a call. I know we, you know, we exchange a lot of emails back and forth every week, but it's quite rare that we get to chat on the phone. So this is a good change.
Yes.
And I was also looking back over our history, and I believe the first time we did business was back in January 2011. Which is very interesting because it goes back 9 years, and the most interesting fact is we've never met face-to-face, which is quite bizarre.
Yeah, that's correct. It's been pretty virtual for almost a decade, it seems, right? So
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it feels like I have met you at some point, but yeah, you're right, we haven't. And I think we've only talked on the phone maybe like less than a handful of times, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, back in the early days, you were working for the Trejo Law Corporation.
Right.
We discussed that particular website project a few times over the phone. And then you were assisting me with some entertainment management contracts, and I believe we spoke again then. But most of the communication has been through email and telephone. I guess that's just the nature of the communication these days. You know, we don't necessarily need to be in the same location, the same office. Technology has made that, you know, easy for the people to communicate in different locations.
Yes, and obviously a lot of businesses these days are finding that useful, you know, given the fact that we're expected to socially distance and maintain certain guidelines. So, you know, I found that to be very helpful in the last couple months, you know, just utilizing technology, utilizing Zoom calls, virtual meetings and things of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely come in very useful in these recent times. So if you don't mind, kind of give yourself a little introduction, tell our listeners what you do, and perhaps how you got started in the legal world.
Well, I'm a bankruptcy attorney. I have a law firm in San Diego, California, and I've been practicing for some years. I went to UCLA Law. I actually went there to study entertainment, but got out of law school during the recession, and there was a very high demand for debt management and debt relief services, bankruptcy included. And I picked up those skills, and jobs were scarce. So I was able to find a job working for a bankruptcy firm where I learned how to put together bankruptcy chapter 7s and 13s, and just realized that it's something that I was pretty good at, and ended up starting my own practice in 2014. And been filing bankruptcies, Chapter 7s primarily, in the San Diego and Los Angeles area for the past 5 years, nearly about 1,000 or so, 900 to 1,000 petitions have been filed in the last 5 years. So It's an area that I'm pretty familiar with, and an area that I enjoy as well.
Great. That's interesting. Now, you mentioned that your early days you had an interest in entertainment law. What's the reason by that? Were you involved in entertainment? Are you a musician or a music interest? What got you into entertainment law primarily?
It's funny that you say that, because a lot of my friends are in entertainment law. They do have some relation to the entertainment industry at some point in their lives. And it's kind of like, okay, if we're going to be a lawyer, we'd like to intersect our interests with practicing. So I did some acting when I was a kid. And then I got heavily into music production when I was a teenager. And I produced and also recorded and worked with various artists, probably up until law school, actually. And so was heavily immersed in the entertainment industry that way. And you know, knew I wanted to sort of intersect the legal practice and music and the legal practice and entertainment. And that's primarily where that interest was derived from. But one thing that you learn as an entertainment lawyer is that you kind of go into it. If you go into it for that reason, to try to intersect something you're interested in, you're a little disappointed, because you're doing something in the industry, but you're not doing the thing that you want to do or that you're good at. So let's say you're a musician and you choose to be an entertainment lawyer. You're going to be around a lot of musicians, but you're not going to be playing music. And it's sort of like seeing, you're going to be exposed to the thing that you'd rather be doing in the entertainment industry, as opposed to,
Yeah. And I guess once you begin to learn more about entertainment law, you soon realize it's like, oh, God, is that how it works? That's not what I thought. I thought I was going to keep all the money in this contract.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you also just realize that it's so, I mean, you're around the creatives, and if you're a creative yourself, and you go into entertainment law, you realize that, you know, the creatives around you are kind of having the free range to be creatives, but you're still the guy doing the contracts. You're still the guy doing the quote unquote non-creative tasks. So I find it to just, you know, if you're in the entertainment industry and you want to be a part of the entertainment industry, you know, I say go for that dream, go for that goal, and to be the talent and not try to satisfy that urge by being the lawyer as well, because they're two very different things.
Now, when you say music, you're involved in music production, so were you kind of more on the technical side, like you were putting music together through a studio or digital music through computers? I mean, what did you work on specifically in music production?
Well, I started out using very basic production equipment, DR5, I think when I was like 14 years old, and I was making music tracks, primarily hip-hop related music tracks, and I ended up using other software, using MPC machines, Fruity Loops, other software that were used to put together music. And I got, you know, my skills grew little by little, and then I got more into the recording side of it. And so then I would work with other producers who would record music, and I would record with them. I would also songwrite for various artists as well. So, you know, that's something I kind of dabbled in during my college years. And and so it was a lot of fun. It's just, as you know, the entertainment industry, you have to have a love for it, for what you're doing to really get by, because it's not something that you should always do with the goal of immediately landing on the top of the charts. You know, it's something that you have to do because you enjoy doing it, whether or not you make a dollar from it or not.
Yeah. That's the most important thing you need to realize, is being an artist in general, whether it's, you know, music, dance, acting, you got to have a passion and love for the art before you even consider making money from it. If you're fortunate enough to make money and earn a living, then, you know, you've got to be extra grateful. But primarily it needs to be just a love and passion for the art. And no matter what happens, you're going to continue doing it. So that's, yeah, it's very important. So how did you transition into entertainment law? Did you see, like, you know, a lot of your entertainment friends and colleagues were struggling with certain legal aspects of it, and you thought you could, you know, get involved in that way and offer, you know, advice and legal services to those types of people? Or did you always have an interest in law that kind of ran parallel with music and music production?
Well, initially, when I wanted to become a lawyer, I was probably about 13 or 14 years old, and it was the criminal defense attorney that I was always aiming to be, and that was just based upon watching it fictionalized in television shows and movies and things like that. You know, I always kind of had this idea that I'd be the guy, you know, exonerating the innocent guy after I find the shred of evidence that clears his name type thing, you know, and I thought it was going to be this really exciting thing, like kind of like you see in the movies. And then I went to law school and dabbled in that sort of work, and I realized that it wasn't exactly what I thought. I mean, there's elements of it, but primarily being a criminal defense attorney is largely paperwork. There's right. not a lot of what you see on TV is a very, 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 very small fraction of what actually happens during that practice. So then I realized, okay, this isn't for me. And as you mentioned just now, Angelo, I had a lot of friends in the entertainment industry that needed help with contracts, that needed help with negotiations and things like that. And I didn't really know how to do a lot of those things, but I was taking entertainment law classes and could at least provide them with some helpful advice and helpful assistance. And so, yeah, I did transition into me helping a lot of friends and colleagues.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of how I got started in the web world. I was, you know, helping out fellow musicians and the bands that I was involved in and building their sites and marketing their social media channels, and then it kind of grew into Sunlight Media. So I kind of understand that process. One interesting project I recall, I think you worked with Jose Trio on is was something with the Michael Jackson Thriller video and a dancer that was part of that video. Were you involved in that project?
Okay, so I wasn't involved in the actual Michael Jackson Thriller video, but what we did do is we represented the co-star of Michael Jackson in that video. And so a woman by the name of Ola Ray, the former Playboy Playmate, and also just the co-star that you see in the video with Michael Jackson, she was suing the Michael Jackson estate for back royalties. And I think they hadn't paid her in over 15 years or something like that. And so, yeah, we were instrumental in essentially filing a lawsuit against the Michael Jackson estate and obtaining a settlement for her.
That's amazing, because if I recall, there were several other lawsuits filed for that same dancer, but a lot of those lawsuits were failed or you know, didn't get approved, but somehow you guys were able to win that. So it's a pretty awesome achievement.
Well, we didn't necessarily win the lawsuit, but we were able to obtain a settlement. You know, basically they threw money at her in order for her to dismiss the lawsuit. So we were able to get them to, yeah, we didn't get what we intended to get, but we did get something from it.
Okay. So she was compensated in the end, ultimately.
Correct.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, what you're doing these days. I know you have the Teal Brown Law Firm, and you're specializing in a lot of other areas of law, especially bankruptcy law, immigration, I believe. So tell us how that law firm came together and why you transitioned into the other services that you're offering now.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Trejo Law Corporation, which is where I was working when I met you. I was working for that law firm. It's a small boutique law firm in Beverly Hills at the time. And we had some marketing help from a fellow by the name of Alex Lopez. And he would assist us with just various marketing efforts and provide us with clients. And he always told me that if I ever started my own practice, that he wanted to be a part of it. And I never really had any aspirations to have my own thing. You know, I never really imagined myself starting a law practice or having my own firm. But Alex and I had a very good working relationship. He told me I was the only lawyer he's ever trusted, or the only lawyer that didn't lie to him. And so he said, yeah, whenever you do your own thing, I want to be a part of it. And he kept pushing me and pushing me. And it took, I want to say maybe 3 years or so of him pushing me to just quit my job and start my own thing, that I finally give in. And he, and thankful to say, he actually financially backed everything in the beginning. He, he basically paid for the office space and all that stuff just so that I could get started. And, you know, we made no money. The law firm made no money for probably about 6 months or so. And, so he was covering the bills and expenses, and he was handling the marketing. And finally, once things got up and running, I want to say probably early 2015 or so, we were able to sustain ourselves, and I ended up just going full time as far as operating the law firm, you know, because I was actually working a job. I was working for someone just to make ends meet while operating my own practice on the side. So it was like a part-time gig. And then once I saw that it was working, I quit my job and then started maintaining the Teal Brown Law Firm full time.
That's awesome. That's good to hear. Great that you have a loyal business partner like Alex. Now, does he have a legal background as well, or is he strictly from like a marketing background?
So Alex is strictly from a marketing background. So what he does is he basically, his company brings me all of my clients. So he has a way of in contacts in the Hispanic community over in San Diego, California. So he's able to get advertisements on radio, print, et cetera, and drive clients to our door. And so he and I have had a marketing relationship ever since I worked at Trejo Law Corporation back in 2010, I believe, is when we started, 2009 or 2010. And so that relationship continues today. He provides me the vast majority of my business.
So he pretty much generates the leads for you through either radio, print, and other forms of advertising. So he generates calls, emails, that type of thing.
Well, generates the leads, and he also gets them to come into the office as well.
Okay.
So he and his people, his team, screen them, conduct the intake, and also he gets them to basically just turn from just a curious prospective client into someone that's actually walking into the office ready to sign a contract.
Awesome. Now, is this the same Alex that I communicate through email with?
Yeah, he's obviously, since he handles the marketing, sometimes he's involved on the side, as far as just the technical side and the advertising and all that. So yeah, it is the same Alex.
The same Alex. Yeah, it's always good to know a little bit of background about the people that you're communicating with. So that's awesome. It sounds like you guys have a really good thing going on there.
And just kind of piggyback on that.
What's that? Sorry.
I was going to say that. Alex is pretty good at obtaining clients through various means, traditional means like radio and print ads and things like that. And obviously we live in different times now. So that's why, you know, with your assistance, I've been trying to build a bigger online presence and also just sort of obtain clients virtually as well, through the web, because I know that's what most companies do these days. We've been lucky enough to get by on traditional means, but I know that that's not going to last forever. That's slowly dissipating by the day. So that's why we're trying to get in good footing as far as just having an online presence and ranking high as well. And I thank Sunlight Media for that opportunity to grow in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to see, you know, the website grow and more traffic come to you. Hopefully in the coming months, we can make that happen with the link building things that we're doing. And yeah, you're right. You know, everyone's using the web these days to find services. You know, it's just a lot more convenient for someone to pick up their phone or tablet and do a quick search and look for, you know, legal services and read reviews and information about the company. It's just it's just the way it is now. And it's, like you said, it's going to get more stronger that way in the months and years to come. So how did you go from setting up? I know you were, I think you're originally from Los Angeles. Is that correct?
I am. Yeah. I'm originally from Los Angeles County. And I know that's kind of rare as far as LA is concerned, because everyone's from somewhere else usually. But I'm actually from LA, and the office is in San Diego, but we also, you know, I live in LA, and I actually just go out to San Diego probably about 3 or 4 days a week. So I kind of pivot between the two cities.
Oh, okay. So you're still here in LA, and you kind of commute back and forth through San Diego. So why did you decide to set up office in San Diego? Did you see more opportunity for business there, or you just preferred to set up office? What was the decision behind that?
Well, as I mentioned, the marketing efforts are largely targeted to the Hispanic community, or at least they were in the very beginning of T.L. Brown Law. And Alex's marketing contacts and radio stations and all that were based in San Diego, near closer to the Mexican border. So a lot of our advertising efforts are down there. So therefore, the majority of our clients, I want to say 93-95% of our clients derive from that area. So it would only make sense to have the office there. And we do have a smaller satellite office in Los Angeles as well, but the majority of our activity is down there.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I'm actually on your website, and I see one of your news blogs or press releases here. And at one point, you're actually offering some free legal services for people, immigrants that were caught up in that whole DACA policy change between the Obama and Trump administration. So it's pretty amazing that you're, you know, offering those types of free legal services. Could you tell us a little bit about that and some of the case studies and people that you helped out during that tough time?
Well, you know, that was during a time when the future of DACA was very uncertain, and we saw an opportunity to use our skills to help out those affected, because we feel that, especially regardless of where your politics stand with immigration, a lot of people can agree that kids who are brought here unwillingly, you know, of no fault of their own, need to be protected to an extent. And there are a lot of kids who, you know, are brought here 2 years old, 3 years old, had no idea what was going on, and they grow up in this country without an ID, or they grew up in this country without any sort of legal citizenship, and find it difficult to even get a job or work legally. And so what DACA was doing was just giving those people an opportunity to even just have a job. And it was a very good program, just in the sense that, you know, the kids had to have clean records. They couldn't have had any criminal history. and they also had to have been in school. So it was only helping people that were good contributors to society, people that weren't causing any trouble, people that were making something of their lives, that were doing well academically as well. And, you know, mm-hmm. we felt those people needed to be protected. And during the changing administrations, those individuals were threatened. Their statuses were threatened. So it doesn't take much for my office to put together a DACA application. And so we were offering to do it for free for people. We just wanted to make sure that they at least got their applications in the door so that they could renew before the deadline. Because at that point, if these applicants didn't renew, they would lose their status forever. And so we were just encouraging them, hey, you know what, we'll put everything together for free. Just make sure you get your paperwork into us so we can make sure you get this submitted. That was our goal. And you know, things aren't always about money. You know, it's great to make a living and do well in business. But every now and then, you know, it's good to do things that just warm your heart and also just make life better for others. You know, it's also good just to help.
Yeah, absolutely. Helping is very positive. And there's, you know, like you said, other things besides money that come from helping people in need. So it's amazing. So what kind of status does it give an individual if they do have that DACA thing? I mean, are they just able to work and study here? Does it guarantee that they can stay forever? Does it give them the option to apply for permanent residency? How does that process, or how did that process work?
Well, the process didn't necessarily give them automatic citizenship or anything like that, but what it did give them is a peace of mind to be able to work and not have to fear being deported, to not have to fear being removed to another country that they've never been to since they were 1 or 2 years old, you know. So a lot of kids always live with that fear that someone's going to barge down their door and take them away in handcuffs. And the DACA status at least said, hey, you're here now. It's no fault of your own. You can work legally. You can earn an income, take care of your family, take care of yourself, and also just pursue degrees, pursue college, pursue your other aspirations in peace without worrying about something happening to you. So they were essentially protected from removal efforts by being granted that status. Yeah. So it didn't automatically just give them citizenship or anything like that, but it was protecting them, saying, okay, we're going to focus our removal efforts on other individuals. We're going to focus our efforts on others who are not these kids.
Right. And then does that give them the option to apply for a green card at some point in their life, or do they always remain with that just a DACA status?
Well, you still needed to meet certain requirements in order to obtain a green card, in order to obtain legal permanent residence or even transition later into a U.S. citizen. You would still need to meet various requirements, and not everyone had those options. Not everyone had a means of getting a green card, because a lot of times, you know, the only way that someone can become a legal permanent resident is marrying someone that's a U.S. citizen or being related directly to someone as a U.S. citizen. Sometimes those are your only options. And it didn't really change that. It didn't really give them an option to apply for a green card, but it did mean that they were here legally, so that if in the future they ever did have an option of applying for a green card, the record would show that they were here legally, that they had a legal status, that they weren't violating the law prior to applying.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. So now, how has that changed now with the Trump administration? How has it affected individuals that were previously accepted as a DACA status? How has that changed for them now?
Well, we were fearful that the program would dissipate completely. We were fearful that the status of all DACA members would just disappear eventually, but there's been a lot of efforts at least to keep those who had gotten their foot in the door within the DACA program. So there's not new DACA applications being accepted, meaning like there's not people, there's not new individuals who had never been a part of the program allowed to enter the DACA program at this time. But we have been able to keep people who were DACA participants and accepted in the DACA program. We were able to keep their statuses alive for the most part.
Okay. That's great. And is that something that they need to renew every year or every couple of years? How does that remain active?
It is frequent renewal. And you're speaking about the differences between the Trump administration and Obama administration. There's a clear, stark difference as far as just the relief that's afforded to immigrants in general, because I have to say that prior to the Trump administration, it was easier to get to relief for those facing removal efforts. And after the Trump administration, unfortunately, we noticed that there were just less recourse available to people. And there was something called prosecutorial discretion, which basically meant that if someone was facing removal efforts, we could possibly just get the whole thing thrown out, just given the fact that the person didn't have a criminal history, that they were, you know, that they had family here, that they were hardworking and staying out of trouble. That was at one point good enough to keep someone here. Now it's not even good enough. You know, now you can be a father of five. In fact, this is actually a client of mine, a father of five who basically worked for a church, had no criminal history, had been here for about, I want to say, 9 years or so. And this guy, we couldn't keep him here. We couldn't even prevent him from being removed. And there was a point in time prior to the Trump administration where individuals like him, you know, they would actually just kind of put them at the back of the queue and focus on more pressing matters, more pressing removal issues. And now, you know, someone of that nature, someone who's never committed a crime, who's been here working hard, who has family, who has U.S. citizen kids here, the law doesn't even protect them to the extent that it did before.
Wow. So he was, in fact, separated from his family and children here?
He was. Yeah, unfortunately, he was. And and it's and you probably aware of all the various cases coming across the border seeking asylum. And asylum, it's a very real thing for some people. There are a lot of people who were persecuted in their countries who are in danger if they stay there. And asylum is something that the U.S. has afforded to many who face those obstacles. And unfortunately, even the asylum applications are very difficult to be granted these days as opposed to in the past.
Yeah, it seems to have been a lot of changes recently. So how does his status differ from his children? Is it because his children were actually born in the U.S. that they get to stay here, and because he wasn't born, he had to go back? I mean, how does it differ between him and his children?
Well, his children were born here, so his children were U.S. citizens, so technically they have all the rights of any other U.S. citizen. They're allowed to stay here, and they're allowed to get driver's licenses and IDs and social security cards and all that stuff and work legally. But yeah, just the fact that this person wasn't born here and that he came here and entered illegally, or possibly even just overstayed a visa, those individuals are treated much more differently. And it doesn't matter that they're the direct parents of U.S. citizens. What matters is where they're born.
Wow, it's so bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. And I don't think the border should just be open. I don't think people should run rampant, obviously. There should be regulation. But I do think that it shouldn't just be a one-size-fits-all situation. I don't think anyone who is here illegally just needs to be tossed out. There's people who are here, you know, let's just say overstayed a visa and afraid to, literally afraid to go back to their country because someone's waiting to kill them. Someone's waiting to take their lives or harm them. And it's a real fear. I actually had a client who was facing asylum. He had actually been kidnapped twice. And he was targeted because his family owned a bit of property and had, I guess, some wealth in that area. So he was always the subject of kidnapping. They would always kidnap him just to demand a ransom from his family. So this guy gets tired of being kidnapped. So he comes over here to the U.S. seeking asylum. And our courts did not think that he had a good enough reason to be here and sent him back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. Yeah, it definitely needs to be dealt with on a case-by-case situation. Like you said, if someone is living here and has children that are born here and they have no criminal history, they should certainly be treated differently than someone that perhaps has a criminal history and no other, you know, family ties. So it's a shame that it's come to that, and hopefully we can make some changes by voting in the right person.
I mean, votes matter, and for anyone who thinks that your vote doesn't matter and it doesn't matter who's in office, trust me, I see firsthand how it affects everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Well, cool. That's pretty amazing that you're involved in that type of work. And it's awesome that, you know, you're helping these people out. Now I guess you're kind of helping people out in a different way, because we've been exposed to this, COVID-19 pandemic. I know it's definitely impacted my business. I know it's impacted yours. So, perhaps we can talk a little bit about that, how you've, you know, managed to keep the business running through COVID-19, and how it's changed how you operate and how it's impacted your business on a personal level.
Currently, right now, we have the entire office working remotely. So I'm at home right now, and my entire staff is at home, and we utilize technology. We utilize Zoom. We utilize video conferencing, phone calls, things of that nature to communicate. And our clients are actually communicating with us via those methods as well. And thankfully, the bankruptcy courts adapted very swiftly. They didn't shut down or anything like that. They immediately adopted a virtual model. So that's been extremely helpful, because I know a lot of other courts have not even figured out what to do, but the bankruptcy courts adopted very fast. And right now, they're basically, you can file a bankruptcy without leaving home. And probably now is the best time to actually file for bankruptcy if you're someone who is nervous about the whole public aspect of it, who's nervous about speaking in front of others and things of that nature, because everything can be done from the comfort of your own home. It's all done over the phone. As far as any hearings are concerned, you don't have to see any judges face to face. And to be honest with you, I feel that that this market's going to get flooded pretty soon, just given the fact that there's so many people who are behind on their rent, who can't afford to pay their rent, who are unemployed, who are living off of public benefits, and all of that's going to catch up. I know there's a lot that the government's doing now to keep things under control, but you and I both know eventually the government aid's going to slow down, and it's not going to catch up to your financial obligations. And I think, you know, getting a few hundred bucks a month for unemployment is not going to sustain a lot of people. So the bankruptcy services are going to be widely sought in the next year or so. And as I mentioned earlier, I think it's a little easier just given the fact that you don't have to actually go to courts. You don't actually go to administrative hearings or anything like that.
That is interesting. Yeah, especially from a legal standpoint, is it always, you know, you have to show up at court in front of a magistrate or have your attorney present. It's interesting that and convenient, obviously, that they're allowing to do that remotely. What options do individuals have when it comes to bankruptcy? You know, what things should they consider before filing? What are some of the different options that are available in terms of, bankruptcy claims for individuals versus businesses or whatever? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, the most popular form of bankruptcy to file is Chapter 7, and that's the one that everyone's really seeking when they think of bankruptcy. They're thinking of Chapter 7 because that's the one that allows you to just get rid of all of your debt and not have to really pay anything in exchange. And not everyone qualifies for Chapter 7. You do have to make a certain level of income depending upon your household. I'm sorry, you shouldn't be making more than a certain level of income depending upon your household size in order to qualify for Chapter 7. But if you do qualify for Chapter 7, in general, all of your unsecured debt goes away. And for the most part, if you don't have a lot of assets and a lot of property, a lot of valuable property to your name, you can keep everything as well. A lot of people feel that bankruptcy is something that's going to cause your house to be sold or your car to be sold or the clothes off of your back to be sold. In some cases it does, but most cases, especially for the average American income, you tend to be able to keep most of your things. Right. And Chapter 13 is a type of repayment situation where instead of discharging all of your unsecured debt, you pay back a portion of it depending upon your income. So for those who don't qualify for Chapter 7, sometimes Chapter 13 is an option, but it does require you to pay back some of your debt.
Okay. Yeah. So you go on some kind of a payment plan where you make monthly payments into an account?
Right. It's a little bit more secure than a debt settlement because with the Chapter 13, you can actually freeze interest, like you don't grow interest or late fees or anything like that. Your creditors can't sue you during that process. They have to abide by the rules of that repayment plan. And so if you owe, let's say, $10,000 to someone and you agree to pay them back over 3 years, they actually have to accept that 3-year plan as long as it's approved by the bankruptcy court. They can't sue you in the middle of it. They can't charge additional interest. They can't charge additional late fees. And so it's really beneficial in that regard.
What happens if you do file for, Chapter 7 or 13 and you have a car payment or something like that, or you have a lease or something? Can the leasing company come along and then just take that vehicle, repossess that vehicle from you, or can you continue having that car provided that you can make those payments?
So if you do have a secured debt, let's say a vehicle, whether it's a lease or a car that you're actually purchasing under in financing, or let's just say a car that you're leasing as well, those creditors have to get permission first in order to continue collecting payments from you. So there's something called a reaffirmation agreement that needs to be signed. So basically, let's assume that you're making payments on a vehicle and you file for bankruptcy, and those payments are being made to, let's say, Honda Finance. And Honda Finance cannot just go and take that car from you. First, they have to abide by the bankruptcy automatic stay, which means that you can't contact anyone, you can't collect, you can't repossess or anything once the bankruptcy is filed. Usually what happens is they reach out to me, the attorney, and ask if the debtor is interested in a reaffirmation agreement. And a reaffirmation agreement basically means that the debtor is entering into a new agreement to repay that debt. And okay. if the debtor does agree to enter into a new agreement to repay the debt, they're allowed to keep the vehicle, even after the bankruptcy is concluded, so long as they keep making those payments.
I see. So negotiating that agreement would mean that perhaps they can get lower monthly payments, or they can extend the terms or the.
That does happen. Yeah, we usually it really just depends upon the creditor or the lender, but you usually can negotiate a reduced balance in some instances. You can sometimes negotiate a reduced interest. You can extend the terms. I even know during COVID-19, some of them are agreeing to just, without us even trying to negotiate with them, they're just agreeing to extend the terms a couple of months and not even force the debtors to make their payments during these months right now. So that's been very helpful as well. I do think that just the pandemic situation has been helpful in that regard, but you know, as I mentioned, I think this is all just temporary relief and band-aids, and business will be as usual, I think, in a few months or so.
Yeah, that's good information for people to know, because I'm presuming that would be one of their biggest concerns is, yeah, I can file for bankruptcy, but am I going to lose my car? You know, how do I get around? How do I pick up my children? How do I, you know, get to my job if I have one, or how do I get to a job interview? So it's good information for people to know that there are options for you when it comes to bankruptcy, especially, you know, being able to keep transfer. That's important.
Yes, and one thing that one helpful thing as well is that I also examine everything before we file. So usually I look over all of their documentation. I review all of their property and assets and everything just to determine what they can protect. So if there is a danger of something being taken, I let them know before we even file. So it's not going to come as a surprise.
Right. Yeah, that's important information for them to know. What about for companies? Does it differ if you have a large company and that company is just not making any more income? Do they just fold the company, or do they actually file for bankruptcy as well? What options are out there for businesses and companies that can no longer make their payments?
Well, if you're a business and you owe a business debts, a business can actually file for bankruptcy on its own. So the owner doesn't necessarily have to file for bankruptcy. The business can actually file a separate bankruptcy just under the business name. And there's various things to consider before deciding whether or not to file under your business. One thing to be aware of is if a bankruptcy is filed by a business, that business is essentially going to close. So if the plan is to continue operating, bankruptcy might not be the best option. At least a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is not the best option for those businesses. So if a business does file for Chapter 7, it's usually just liquidating. But I do have clients that come to me and they wonder, should their business file or should they file? And a lot of times it really just depends on what your concern is. If the debt is owed to the business and primarily the business only, you have to determine whether or not that owner is going to be personally liable for it. So let's just say there's a business that owes a debt, but somehow their owner is completely protected. And let's say like in the situation of an LLC, you know, it usually protects the members from personal liability. So if an LLC has a debt and owes a debt to someone, usually the owners are not going to be personally liable for it. But in certain instances, let's just say there's a corporation that owes a debt, but the owner also is on the hook as well. That's a situation where the owner might want to file herself, I should say, because if the business files for bankruptcy, they're just going to come right after the owner. So in those situations, it might be best just for the owner to file on their own and protect themselves.
And I guess, again, it depends on what type of business they have set up. Like you said, if it's an LLC, it does protect them to a certain extent. What other types of businesses would protect the owner? Is it incorporated? Is that the other one?
Well, if something's incorporated, if it's an Inc., if it's a corporation, there's certain lines of protection, but there's also instances where the corporate veil can be pierced, which is the term. So basically it means that they can sometimes go after the owner directly in certain instances. It's a little complex to explain, but in a nutshell, if an owner has a corporation and there are certain things in place that basically just mean that this corporation is only here to protect the owner and that they're basically one and the same person, sometimes they can actually go directly after the owner. And that's why LLCs are so popular, because LLCs do afford a lot more protection to the owners. If a business ends up highly indebted, usually the owner usually can just shut down the business and move on without worrying about being personally sued for that debt.
Interesting. So in the other instance, if you're a business owner and you only have a DBA, then that's when the actual debt collectors can come after the individual and not just the business. Is that correct?
If you're a business owner and you have a DBA, it sounds like a lot of times you're operating as a sole proprietor and you're basically the business. So, if the business owes something, they can also come after the owner.
Right. Yeah, this is very valuable information to businesses and individuals out there that are looking to, you know, set up a business. So I'm hearing another blog post here, Tristan. I think we should go into the types of different businesses that you can set up and what protections you have for those types of businesses. So something you might want to consider.
Yeah.
But it's definitely
something I can draw up and definitely. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. People need to know what their options are when
of course.
It comes to this sort of stuff. Yeah, that's really cool. I imagine it's a very difficult time now for a lot of individuals and businesses through this, COVID situation. What other options do you think are out there? I know that, the SBA has put out some offers for business loans. Obviously, we've had the stimulus checks, but they're, quite minimal. What other options do you think businesses have during this time?
As you mentioned, the PPP loans are extremely helpful for businesses. I know that they ran out of funding on the first wave. I'm not certain exactly how the second wave is going, but that was extremely helpful for small businesses. It was basically loans that didn't have to be paid back so long as you spent 75% on your employees. As long as you spent 75% on your payroll, those loans did not have to be paid back. And that's extremely helpful for a struggling business during this time. Whether or not there's going to be additional relief added to that over the upcoming months, I know that Congress is debating that currently, but, I'm hopeful that there's additional relief for small businesses, because obviously this is just going to kind of keep things under control, I would say, for maybe a few months or so before the effects of the pandemic really hit. Because as you know, we're just in the beginning stages of this thing. It's we're not going to really see the effects on everything until later months. And that's when the relief is really going to be needed. As far as help that's afforded to individuals, I do know that unemployment right now is being very generous to those who are awarded unemployment claims. So there are added amounts being given to individuals who file for unemployment. I know that they even extended unemployment to independent contractors as well, which is something that does not usually happen.
Yeah, I think they call that the PUA status or something? Is that what the,
Right, and that's usually not the case as far as unemployment is concerned, so that's unprecedented. And right now I think that there's going to be, you're going to see a lot of relief coming towards various industries as well, various industries that are really hard hit by this, not just the general small businesses, but I think you're going to see relief coming towards a lot of the entertainment-related industries as well that have been really hit by this. There's probably going to be additional stimulus checks sent out. I think that they're debating currently whether or not to send out a second stimulus check, and we should find out the status of that within the upcoming months.
That's interesting. Yeah, entertainment's definitely been largely hit. You know, a lot of my musician friends are out of work and looking to take on different career paths and looking at other options. So it's definitely difficult for them. I have clients that run, you know, salons. Obviously, very difficult for them. Beauticians, gyms, that type of, you know, one-on-one personal interaction is extremely challenging for those types of business models. So hopefully there is some relief for them. So what are some good online resources you would recommend people look at in terms of what options are available for them?
Well, one thing that they can always look at is if you're a small business owner, you can go to SBA.gov, the Small Business Association. And so they tend to have a lot of help as far as how to apply for any sort of relief pertaining to small business owners, whether or not it's a mom and pop retail store or a, you know, a small law firm, or even if it's just a small restaurant. You should be able to apply for the Paycheck Protection Program, which is the PPP loan. And those individuals should be, if you're allowed to actually get in the door, it's a very low bar to actually apply for and be approved for a small business loan. And again, that's, this is a loan that does not have to be repaid. I know that, that the funding for this is very, very limited, and I believe that they have run out as far as the funding that's currently being allotted, but they are, Congress has definitely been approving additions to that program in recent months as well.
Okay. That's good to know. So SBA.gov is a good resource to look at what options are available for, is that for individuals and businesses or mainly just businesses?
It's mainly for businesses. I would say you would want to go to EDD, to your local employment development department. In California, it's edd.ca.gov. But for other states, you would have to look at the unemployment department, and they should have information on their websites as far as how to apply for relief and how to obtain unemployment benefits.
Excellent. Yeah, definitely some good resources there for people to look at. Well, this has been great. I've really enjoyed this conversation. There's been a lot of good information for people to, you know, obtain and think about. I would definitely like to do this again, maybe post-COVID, to see how things changed and progressed. But yeah, it's been a great chat. I appreciate you being a part of the podcast today. And yeah, thanks again. I look forward to doing this again sometime real soon.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite and thank you for having me. I look forward to doing this again too.
Absolutely. Well, best of luck during this tough time, and I'm sure you and I will be chatting frequently. So looking forward to those.
Definitely.
And yeah, you enjoy the rest of your day.
All right. Thank you. Take care, Angelo.
All right. You as well, Tristan. All the best.